Given the assaults of Hadrian, his creation of Aelia Capitolina, the prevention by the Byzantines of any true Jewish life in Jerusalem, it should be wondrous in our eyes that after these hundreds of years, after so many attempts to destroy the Jewish connection to Jerusalem, the centrality of Jerusalem in the Jewish spiritual world was nevertheless restored. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 127, Sacred Time and Sacred City. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It is a small and fascinating story in halachic history, taking its place among the queries and responsa that make up the tradition of Jewish law, and it is one that I recount in an essay that I published on Judah Halevi. In 1940, fleeing the Nazi hordes, hundreds of young yeshiva students found salvation in the unlikely form of Chiyune Sugihara, the Japanese consul in Kovno, whose visas allowed them to cross the continent on the Trans-Siberian Railway, arriving in Kobe following three perilous days on a ferry sailing the Sea of Japan. Having escaped the German death camps, these Jews now addressed a complex Jewish legal conundrum. When was the Sabbath to be observed in Japan? It was assumed by convention that Saturday began in Japan several hours ahead of Jerusalem, but did Jewish law agree? After all, where the first moment of the day begins is, for international law, purely a matter of convention, and it is not obvious whether Shabbat starts in Japan before or after it begins in Jerusalem. While these querying Jews had the option of observing 2 days of the Sabbath, the options were less clear when it came to the fast of Yom Kippur. These Jews reached out to the rabbis of the land of Israel, and in a famous gathering that took place in the home of Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer, some of the most influential spiritual authorities in the Holy Land gathered to discuss this question that had been sent from the other side of the world. Ultimately, a disagreement took place between one of the senior rabbis of Jerusalem, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky, and a younger rabbi whose own halachic influence would become immense, Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, known as Chazon Ish. The argument was not resolved to the satisfaction of all sides, with the Jews in Japan receiving different instructions from different rabbis. And there are debates stemming from that discussion to this day. What those Jews in Japan did and how the rabbinic arguments were drawn from the medieval writings of Halevi and of others could be a lecture in itself. But the story strikingly parallels in various ways a controversy that occurred 1,000 years earlier, when the Jewish spiritual leader in Jerusalem engaged in a debate regarding the Jewish calendar with a young scholar who would go on to dominate the Jewish intellectual world. And that episode itself, rightly interpreted, also tells us about the enduring, constant Jewish connection to Jerusalem. By the 10th century, under the rulership of the Fatimid dynasty, there was again an important Jewish community in Jerusalem, with a yeshiva, a place of worship that seems to have been inside one of the walls of the Temple Mount, and a series of rituals known throughout the diaspora that kept the temple very close to mind. These rituals were prayers that took place on the Mount of Olives, first and foremost, as we discussed, on Hoshana Rabbah, the seventh day of Sukkot. And, as we also mentioned yesterday, it was on that day that the Jewish leadership in the Holy Land would announce the calendar, drawing on the cycle established by Hillel II centuries before. What this means is that the Jewish community's connection to Jerusalem had been truly physically restored, and it had become again one of the central communities in the Jewish world, joining the yeshivas and communities of Babylon, along with their leaders, the Gaonim and the Exilarch, known as Rosh HaGolah, Resh Galuta, the political leader of Babylonian Jewry. As the historian Menachem Ben Sasson tells us, quote, "The basic structure of the institutions and organization of Jewish leadership was rooted in the pre-Islamic period. Following the Muslim conquests, the leadership of the two sacred centers in Babylonia and the land of Israel was regarded as authoritative, both by the Jews themselves and by the non-Jewish rulers of these regions. Jewish leadership in these centers was concentrated in the four yeshivot, the three Babylonian yeshivot of Sura Pumbedita and the exilarch Rosh HaGolah who sat in Baghdad, and the yeshiva of the land of Israel," end quote. Sasson also tells us that the Jewish communities of North Africa also exerted an enormous influence over the yeshiva of the land of Israel. This, he writes, was due to the position of political leadership that developed there, the Jewish position known in Hebrew as Nogid, which, Sasson writes, quote, "held informal authority over the North African diaspora and the authority to allocate the monetary contributions to the land of Israel and to Babylon," end quote. We thus have the Babylonian communities and the North African communities, each interacting with and impacting the yeshiva of the land of Israel, whose spiritual center was in Jerusalem. It is the calendrical controversy of the 10th century that in an interesting way reflects the interplay of these communities. In the early 920s, at the Hoshana Rabbah gathering atop the Mount of Olives, the spiritual leader of the yeshiva of the Holy Land, Aharon ben Meir, announced an interpretation of the calendar that was then opposed by Babylonian Jewish leadership, one in which the months of Cheshvan and Kislev would both have 29 instead of 30 days, which meant that Jewish scholars disagreed as to when Passover would be observed in the year to come, as well as the next Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. One of the most significant figures in this controversy lived a life that spanned all of these Jewish communities. His name was Sadia, who grew up in Egypt, studied in the Holy Land, and was later appointed to serve as leader of one of the Babylonian yeshivas, forever becoming known as Sadia Gaon, one of the most significant commentators, halakhic authorities, and philosophers in Jewish history. Sadia's rise to prominence was linked to his criticism of Aharon ben Meir's calendar. A copy of one of his letters, given to us by Henry Malter in his biography of Sadia, allows us to understand the seriousness of the stakes. Sadia wrote, quote, "Know that when I was yet in Aleppo, some pupils came from Baal Gad and brought the news that Ben Meir intends to proclaim Cheshvan and Kislev deficient. I did not believe it, but as a precaution, I wrote to him in the summer. The exilarch, the heads of the academies, all the alufim, teachers and scholars likewise agreed to proclaim Cheshvan and Kislev full and that Passover be celebrated on Thursday. In conjunction with their letters, I too wrote to most of the great cities in order to fulfill my duty. Persist ye also in this matter and close up this breach and do not rebel against the command of God. None of the people dare to profane the festivals of God willfully, to eat leavened bread on Passover, and eat, drink, and work on the Day of Atonement. May it be the will of the Lord that there be no stumbling block and no pitfall in your place or in any other place in Israel." End quote. It seems strikingly that there may indeed have been Jews in the Holy Land who for a year or two followed the calendar proclaimed by Ben Meir on the Mount of Olives, observing certain holidays on different days than their brethren in the diaspora. In the end, Sadia won. But we would draw the wrong lesson if we only focus on his victory. What we see here from this story is the incredible fact that Jerusalem had restored itself as a central religious community in the Jewish world. And the fact that the Jewish community of Jerusalem was so central during the 10th century is incredible, given all that had occurred in the past millennium, given the assaults of Hadrian, his creation of Aelia Capitolina, the prevention by the Byzantines of any true Jewish life in Jerusalem. It should be wondrous in our eyes that after these hundreds of years, after so many attempts to destroy the Jewish connection to Jerusalem, the centrality of Jerusalem in the Jewish spiritual world was nevertheless restored. This centrality can also be seen in the devotion of the Jewish political leadership in North Africa to the sacred city. Thus, F.E. Peters provides us with the chronicle of the Achimaatz family, which contains descriptions of Jewish life in this period, including the North African Jewish political leader Paltiel. I cite the passage he brings us, along with his explanatory parentheses, included in the quote. The citation describes Rabbi Paltiel being called to the Torah. Quote, "When he had finished the reading, he vowed to the God of his praise 5,000 dinars of genuine and full value, 1,000 for the head of the yeshiva and sages, 1,000 for the mourners of the sanctuary, 1,000 for the yeshiva of the Gaonim at Babylon, 1,000 for the poor and needy in various communities, and 1,000 for the exaltation of the Torah, for the purchase of the necessary oil. In the morning he arose early and hurried off, for he was always zealous in observing the law, so that his evil inclination might not prevail over him to prevent him from carrying out his good intention. He hired men, horses, and mules, provided guards, and sent them to accompany the caravans that traveled through the deserts of Sinai. They delivered the gold pieces, as Rabbi Paltiel, their master, had ordered, and they distributed them among the schools and synagogues, and the mourners of Zion, and the poor of the communities of Israel." End quote. Here, as with the letter in the Cairo Geniza from the land of Egypt that we cited previously, we find fascinating information. We see a Jewish community in North Africa whose leaders are dedicated to supporting Jewry and Judaism in Jerusalem, who donate funds to the yeshiva in Jerusalem, as well as to the yeshivas of Babylon. And then, in the same account, we find the following about Paltiel's son. Quote, "He dedicated in the name of the Most High, so that it might be accounted righteousness for himself by him who dwells in the clouds, 20,000 gold drachmas for the poor and the afflicted and the scholars and instructors who are teaching the Torah, and for teachers of children and readers of prayer, and oil for the inner altar of the sanctuary at the western wall, and for the synagogues and communities far and near, and for those who were mourning the loss of the temple, those who grieved and mourned for Zion, and for the teachers and their students in the yeshiva in Jerusalem, and for the scholars of Babylon and the yeshiva of the Gaonim there. End quote. Here, too, we have a description of the spiritual life in Jerusalem, including, most fascinatingly, quote unquote, the inner altar of the sanctuary at the Western Wall, which seems to refer, again, to the cave synagogue that we have previously discussed. We are also told about support for those, quote unquote, mourning the loss of the temple. As F.E. Peters comments, this seems to refer to those Jews who had made a vocation of mourning in Jerusalem for the temple on behalf of the Jewish people, reflecting a dedication to the memory of the temple that was supported by diasporan Jewry. All this again indicates the incredible restoration of Judaism in Jerusalem, how this community became, after so many years of Jews being banned from Jerusalem, again a locus and focus of the devotion and support of the Jewish world. Of course, this Jewish community in Jerusalem would not last, and we will see how the Crusades dealt a terrible blow to the Jewish presence in the sacred city. But then, of course, as we will also see, restoration began again, continuing the tale of a people's connection to a city that could never be undone. This is Meir Soloveitchik. Looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.